Welcome to the Science Podcast for May 4th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, targeting cells in vivo with nanoparticles, water-driven surface alteration on Mars, and nanopore genomic sequencing, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
As the field of nanotechnology progresses, scientists have been fusing the organic and inorganic into ever tinier, ever more complex machines. Imagine targeting these tiny machines to specific cells in the body and then controlling their behavior from afar. I spoke with Jeffrey Friedman about his proof of concept paper on using metallic nanoparticles as receivers for remote insulin control in mice.
Many people expect that nanotechnology will make an impact on medicine. Already it's being applied to drug delivery and other applications, and we wanted to explore the possibility that nanotechnology could also be used to activate or modulate the activity of cells. So we set out to test this, and we were able to show that one could develop a system in which the expression of a protein, in this case insulin, could be controlled by nanoparticles responding to radio waves. And the way the experiment was done, in fact, we could expose an appropriately engineered cell injected into a mouse to a radio wave and cause a reduction in blood glucose in that animal. This represents a proof of principle that nanoparticles can be applied to modulate cellular activity in living animals.
Okay, well, let's go into what exactly your system entails. What did you use in nanoparticles, and what were you trying to do with them?
Okay, so the nanoparticles we used are made of metal, and we start with the knowledge that if you expose a metal to a radio wave, it will heat. And everyone knows this because it's for this reason, for example, that you don't want to put your silverware in a microwave oven.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the additional technical capability of nanoparticles in the modern world is that you can decorate these particles with proteins or other reagents. Now, in order to try to use nanoparticles, at least of the sort that are currently available, to change cellular activity, we needed to address two challenges. We had to direct the particle to specific cells,
mm-hmm.
and then we had to somehow transduce that heat into a cellular signal. We accomplished the first aim by decorating the nanoparticles with an antibody directed against a channel that we would engineer to be expressed in the cell line that we used.
So the antibody was there to tell the nanoparticles to go to a very specific place.
That's right. So that directing the nanoparticles to specific cells becomes possible because you can put a exquisitely sensitive antibody onto its surface, and that will now direct the particle to a cell that expresses the target of that antibody.
Mm-hmm.
In the experiment we did, the target of the antibody was a very special channel that normally conveys thermal pain in the body. So when you're exposed to a high temperature, such as if you touch a stove and sense that heat or the pain, it's because this channel opened in response to the temperature. So what we did was we expressed that channel in some cell line that doesn't normally express it, and we put a little bit of a tag on that channel, which is the target for the antibody. So the idea was the antibody-coated nanoparticle can find its way directly to this channel,
mm-hmm.
and when exposed to a microwave, it will activate the channel.
And so when the channel is activated, that's when you get to see a change in the behavior of the cell?
So there's one more step, which is that we now need to transduce, as it's referred to, the opening of this channel into a cellular response. And so we made a new genetic construct that is designed to increase expression of a gene when calcium enters the cell. So this channel, which is called TRPV1, gates calcium. When calcium flows in, it activates the synthetic gene construct to produce insulin.
It's a really complicated system.
I would say in some ways it's actually not that complicated,
uh-huh.
because what we're really doing is introducing two synthetic gene constructs into a cell, which isn't so many. One is the channel, which is also the target for the nanoparticle, and then the other is the gene construct that responds to it.
Mm-hmm.
We also developed a different system that doesn't even require you to inject nanoparticles. It turns out that there's a protein in cells called ferritin, and it binds to iron and can form endogenous nanoparticles. So in separate experiments that are analogous, we expressed in the same cell the temperature-sensitive channel and ferritin, which forms metal nanoparticles inside the cell, and also showed that that can gate calcium, at least in cultured cells.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the advantages of this system?
Well, I think the main advantage of this is that it allows you to regulate the activity or expression of cells remotely without the need for any implanted device, potentially. You know, I think the key point that I would like to emphasize is that this is just a very early first step. I mean, this is a long way away from prime time. You know, we wanted to ask a specific question, which is, can you engineer a system to remotely control the activity of cells in an animal? We answered that question, but having done that is a long way away from having a new treatment.
Right.
On the other hand, it sets the stage maybe for future developments that might someday make that possible.
Right. So the details are for to be determined in the future.
Yeah.
So you demonstrated this could work in cells and also in mice. What were some of the challenges of getting it to work in vivo?
I would say that there were just several steps along the way, each of which had to be optimized. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, each step had to be taken in animals with attention paid to what the exposure times to the microwaves would be, what the intensity of the microwave would be, what the frequency of the microwave would be, and so on. So that even though it was feasible to test each of the individual steps in cultured cells, putting all of them together to get it to work into an animal required quite a lot of experimentation.
So you set this up to induce insulin expression. Is diabetes one of the diseases that you envision this as being useful for?
Well, we used insulin because it's a well-established protein with a very easy-to-assess readout. In this case, if you overproduce insulin, it lowers blood glucose. And I suppose it's imaginable that at some point in the distant future, one could potentially want to use a system like this to control insulin. However, it's also worth pointing out that there are many other treatments for diabetes right now, and I don't think there's any expectation that this will enter the clinical armamentarium for diabetes anytime soon. So we used insulin mainly as to prove that we could get a system like this to work. We have been thinking through what some clinical applications might be in the future, pending many other developments and improvements. I mean, this is a long way away from being a new form of treatment, but it lays the foundation for potentially using nanotechnology to deliver proteins to patients or activate cells. Some of the early things we've thought about would be to use a system like this potentially to deliver proteins in parts of the body that are hard to target, such as the brain. So, for example, there are certain genetic disorders of brain development that are the result of a protein deficiency, and they, at least in animals, can be treated by delivering the protein into the brain. And so the sort of thing we've thought about is that perhaps we could use a system like this to control the production of the relevant protein without having to inject the brain repetitively.
Yeah. What are the next steps for this research? Are you looking for ways to improve this system or build on it?
Yeah, I think some of the key next steps for us are to continue to develop the system in animals, to test the ferritin endogenous nanoparticle system in animals. Mm-hmm. And we'd also like to see if we can develop the system so as to deliver proteins directly into hard-to-target places, such as the brain. And lastly, the question would have to be addressed as to how do you deliver these engineered cells into an animal. And so we'd also like to try to develop protocols for purifying stem cells directly from animals, such as from fat, and seeing if we can derivatize an animal's own cells in such a way as to make them responsive to the microwaves.
Great. Well, Jeffrey Friedman, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Jeffrey Friedman and colleagues write about heating nanoparticles with radio waves in a report this week.
Nearly 8 years after first landing on Mars, against all expectations, the Opportunity rover is still chugging along and shedding light on a dusty and desolate planet. In August 2011, it reached Endeavour Crater, where scientists believe they found evidence of a type of water-rich environment not previously observed on Mars. Raymond Arvidson, deputy principal investigator of the Mars Exploration Rover missions, spoke with me about the implications of the findings.
Opportunity, after traveling 33,000 meters, is sitting on an ancient outcrop from a 22,000-meter diameter crater called Endeavor, and we found evidence for an ancient impact breccia. And also part of that material has been modified in what we think is hot water. And then the second major punchline is there's a bench of sedimentary rock surrounding it that's cut, and the fractures are filled with a mineral gypsum. And gypsum forms in water. It's calcium sulfate with two water molecules in its unit cell. And the conditions are a lot less acidic than the conditions for most of the sedimentary rock we've been investigating since 2004.
Let's start by talking about Opportunity. This is quite a unique little rover. Can you just tell me about what it's been up to there on Mars and how long it's been there?
Yeah, Opportunity is way out of warranty. You know, it landed in January 2004. It was designed for 90 to 180 Mars days or sols. And today we're planning, believe it or not, sol 2,940. Most of the instruments and capabilities on Opportunity are still operational. Not everything. You know, it's like your great-great-granddad's worth of rover. So we can still drive, although we're parked for the winter right now. The imaging systems still all work well. The robotic arm can still get down to the surface. We can do close-up imaging. We can do composition. The Mossbauer spectrometer seems to have had better days. And the mini-tests, the emission spectrometer, hasn't worked for a couple years. But otherwise, you know, all systems are go. And at some point in the next few weeks to a month, we'll be done with the current winter campaign. The sun will be high enough in the sky that we'll be able to drive off the winter site called Greeley Haven and continue exploration of these ancient outcrops on the rim of Endeavor.
So this, what is it, 2,900 sols? I mean, this is around 8 years, right?
That's right. I mean, I never expected to be planning a science operations working group meeting, a tactical shift in April 2012. I mean, Steve Squire is the principal investigator, and we were betting each other, would we last 90 days, would we last 180 days, but holy smokes, 2,940 sols on Mars Day. Nobody had any idea that the vehicles would go this long. They're just well-made American vehicles.
Okay, well, let's move on to Endeavor Crater now. So what are the unique features here in this area, and why do they point to the presence of water?
Oh, good question. So we've seen Endeavor Crater for a long time, for the past few years, and we finally made it to Endeavor back in August. And what's interesting about these rocks is they're ancient rocks as compared to the sedimentary strata we've been investigating since January 2004 through August. And what's in our science paper is that some of these rocks have been modified in hot water. And from orbit with the CRISM instrument, which is a hyperspectral imaging system on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, another NASA orbiter, we see evidence for the presence of clay minerals, a mineral called smectite. And then in the surrounding bench, kind of right at the perimeter of Cape York and the rest of these rim segments, we see evidence for gypsum, calcium sulfate with two waters. So gypsum, the hydrothermal fluids, the clay minerals all point to a more neutral pH or water conditions relative to the sedimentary strata we drove on from January 2004 through August 2011. You know, and water is the kind of elixir of life, but particularly water with more neutral conditions than the acidic conditions in the sedimentary strata. So we're really anxious to leave the current winter site, Greeley Haven, and explore more of the outcrops on Cape York and Botany Bay, which is some ancient sedimentary strata between Cape York and other rim segments to the south. And eventually, you know, this vehicle never seems to stop, gets to Cape Tribulation, which has the mother load of these clay minerals, these smectites, as observed in the CRISM data. So there's still a lot to do. And it's an ancient environment, older than we've been exploring for most of the mission, and a water-rich environment with more neutral pH conditions and more likely to have been a habitable zone.
So the presence of clay minerals and gypsum actually implicates water because they have water molecules trapped within their crystal structures. But the pertinent information here is actually the pH conditions at which they're formed?
That's what we think. And in fact, the identification of the clay minerals is based on the water or the OH, the hydroxyl radicals in their unit cells, in their minerals.
So have you begun to speculate where this water would have come from? Was it just circulating groundwater, or was it kind of rising from deeper within the planet?
I think that it's actually rising groundwater. The earliest part of Mars, in this area, there was extensive snowfall, perhaps rainfall, and extensive erosion that removed mass and made the channels and delivered that sediment to the northwest. We're sitting on a plain that's tilted to the northwest. And that's when Endeavour formed. That's when the hydrothermal deposits were present. That's when there was surface alteration to form the clay minerals in addition to hot water. And then the environment moved to one of kind of gentle rising groundwater with recharge probably from snowfall and rainfall further uphill, uphill being, you know, hundreds of kilometers to the southeast. And we think that volcanism may have been extensive, and there was a lot of sulfur emitted from volcanoes and chlorine, and this stuff just collected with basaltic sand in these low areas, occasionally moist, and formed these sulfate sandstones that we see today. And that was kind of the last gasp of major aqueous activity on the planet, and then we went to this pretty dry, cold set of conditions that have dominated most of geologic time. You know, there's still a little bit of liquid water occasionally coming out based on the recent gullies and the other activity that we see, but I think the sulfates located in other low spots where groundwater would be upwelling kind of represents the drying out period, the last gasp of Mars in terms of major aqueous activity.
So what's the greater significance here? How does this help shape our understanding of the formation of Mars?
Well, I think, you know, what we need to do is still collect and analyze a lot of data. And, of course, we have Curiosity landing on August 5th in a location called Gale Crater, which has a 5,000-meter-high stack of layered sediments. It's like a strip chart recorder for Mars, right, where you go from the bottom of the section with the clay minerals to the intermediate section with these hydrated sulfates to the top of the section. So they may be lake bed deposits. So the vehicle Curiosity is much more capable in terms of analytical instruments than either Spirit or Opportunity, and will have the capability to search for organics in the clays. We'll be able to pin down the exact clay phases. And this all tells us, or will tell us, collectively with all the data we have and will collect, about how Mars has evolved through time. And one working hypothesis that I keep in my mind is early in geologic time, a lot of degassing, a lot of impacts, a lot of volatiles in the atmosphere, a magnetic field, and that's a good time to have occasional warm, wet periods where there's a lot of erosion and transport, channel formation. And then as the magnetic field was decaying, there was still a lot of volcanic activity. So you move to this kind of more gentle phase where you have groundwater upwelling in the low areas and oxidizing conditions in the atmosphere, and you form the layered sulfates. For most of the time, it's been pretty cold and pretty dry, and layers that would have formed would have been more anhydrous. So there's still a lot to do on this planet, but it looks like earlier you go, the wetter the conditions, and the more neutral the pH, and the more likely conditions would have been habitable. So we're trying to put the whole picture together.
Great. Well, Raymond Arvidsson, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Raymond Arvidsson and colleagues read about ancient water on Mars in this week's Science. In a recent World Economic Forum report on the global quality of math and science education, the United States ranked number 48. Sheila Tobias addresses this unsatisfactory score in an editorial in this week's issue called Empowering Science Teachers. Meghna Sachdev spoke with her about pre-college science teaching in the U.S.
As we define a profession, a professional has to have control over the parameters of the work he or she does. Unless we fix what's broken, unless we re-professionalize science teaching at the high school level, there's no amount of manipulation of syllabi or web-based learning or new textbook gimmicks that's going to bring back a large cohort of the students who choose not to study science in college because they did not have a positive experience studying science in high school.
You can listen to the whole interview by visiting this week's editorial at www.sciencemag.org.
At the turn of the century, it took about 3 years to sequence a human genome. While technology is speedier today, processing a genome still takes a substantial amount of time, and machines that read DNA require a lot of lab space and lab money. I spoke with Elizabeth Panisi about an old idea that is just now becoming a feasible technique for quick genome sequencing in cheap handheld devices.
Well, every February there's a meeting in Florida where all people interested in genome sequencing technology come to hear about the latest innovations. Here's where the companies really make bold statements about what they're planning to do. And at this year's meeting, a company called Oxford Nanopore Technologies wowed the crowd with a handheld sequencer. And it said it would decipher almost a billion bases of DNA in less than a day. That's way faster than current technology, and I was very curious about it, and I became even more fascinated by the technology when I found out it's been more than 20 years in development.
So how fast are these compared to the sequencing that we use now or that was done in the past, like, say, the first human genome?
Well, the first human genome took about 3 years to do. Now they can sequence a human genome in about a week. And with these new technologies, depending on how many sets of pores you use, they're talking about doing it in an hour.
Wow. So as you mentioned, a working prototype of this technology has been a long time coming. The idea in itself has been around for a while. Can you kind of describe basically what nanopore sequencing is?
So with nanopore sequencing, the basic idea is pretty simple. You thread DNA through a very tiny pore and read the order of the bases as the DNA strand passes through the pore. The pores are about 25,000 times smaller than a human hair, so that the base squeezes by one base at a time. In one version of nanopore sequencing, you have a stream of ions passing through the pore, and what happens is the DNA base partially blocks the ion current and changes what the current is, and you have sensitive electronics to measure the current. So what happens is each base goes through, it records the changes, and you get distinctive patterns that signify what the bases are.
And these pores are, they're proteins?
These pores are proteins, yes.
So you said it was faster. What are some of the other improvements that this technology might have over current methods for sequencing DNA?
Well, current methods require that you copy the DNA to be sequenced many times over, and that takes time and money for reagents. With nanopore sequencing, you don't need to do that.
And you also said it was a handheld device?
Yeah, that a little bit bigger than a thumb drive.
And normal DNA sequencing facilities now are much, much larger.
Right. A normal DNA sequencer basically takes up a whole lab bench.
This is a really cool idea that came up, what, in the 80s?
Yeah, in 1989, a scientist who was working on the origins of life actually was thinking about a way to get molecules into these artificial synthetic cells that he was making. So he came up with this idea of using a channel, and then thinking about it further, he thought about how it might be possible to get DNA through this channel, and if you could monitor the DNA, how you might be able to sequence. Mm-hmm. He didn't really follow up on this idea for many years, but he first thought about it in 1989.
And what have been some of the challenges to actually bringing that idea to fruition?
Well, one of the biggest challenges was finding a channel or a pore that would be big enough to have the DNA go through. Mm-hmm. And then another challenge is controlling how fast the DNA goes through and how you might actually be able to distinguish the different bases as they go through.
So there's now a working prototype of the system where researchers have been able to pass DNA through a pore. But as you pointed out in the article, even though this has been successfully used for sequencing, there's still a pretty high error rate. What are the researchers going to do about that?
Well, it's a company that's saying this, so you have to take that with a grain of salt. Okay. But so they have reported that they have sequenced a viral genome all in one stretch, and they have reported that in their sequencing projects they have an error rate of 4%, which sounds like a lot, but for a beginning technology, it's fairly reasonable, and they're pretty certain they can get that error rate down.
This is all using proteins and membranes to as components for this system. But you also write about some groups that are ditching biomolecules altogether and going straight for silicon. What are some of the advantages of doing it that way?
Right. So the way this nanopore sequencing works right now is you have the protein pores embedded in a lipid bilayer, and those membranes are fairly sensitive and fragile. They're fairly fragile. And so when you're manufacturing something for commercial use, you want something that's very robust. So the idea is if you could make a solid-state pore, say made out of silicon or graphene, that would be more robust. And the other advantage of using silicon is we already have a very well-developed technology with semiconductors for making silicon chips in whatever configuration that we want, and we could apply that toward making solid-state pores.
So if systems like this, you know, that are tiny and fast become available widely in the next few years, what kind of changes can we expect to see in research or in clinical applications?
Well, it's hard to anticipate what kind of changes there will be. I mean, one thing that's appealing is when you have a portable sequencer that can sequence basically on the fly, you might use it in more field settings, such as to detect infectious diseases or to detect microbial contamination of food, any number of things.
All right. Well, Elizabeth Panisi, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Panisi wrote a news focus on emerging nanopore technology in this week's issue.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. So Dave, let's start with an unusual relationship between dolphins and humans.
Well, Carrie, this study has to deal with a population of dolphins that live off the coast of Laguna, Brazil. And what's really unusual about these dolphins is they actually seem to help the Brazilian fishermen in the area fish. And the way they do this is they go out to sea and they herd these schools of small silverfish, which are called mullets, toward the shore where the fishermen are waiting with their lines. And as soon as the dolphins get close, they slap their heads and tails against the surf. And that's sort of a signal to the humans to go ahead and start fishing. It's really strange. It's not been seen anywhere else in the world. And what this new study is about is really trying to figure out, why are the dolphins doing this?
Mm-hmm. Did they get anything out of it?
Well, that's a great question. It's not clear whether the dolphins get anything out of it. It's not clear if they're getting food out of it or something else. And it's also not clear, you know, why they're doing it in the first place. This is something that's been going on for generations. Why has this persisted? So what the researchers did in this study was they actually went out in some boats around Laguna, Brazil, and they took photos of a bunch of the dolphins. There's about 50 dolphins living in the community over here. And what they found is some of the dolphins were a lot more social than other ones. Some of them stuck to sort of close-knit groups. They always sort of hung out with other dolphins, while others kept more to themselves. They were sort of more antisocial. And the team also found a correlation between the dolphins that tended to stick together with each other were the same dolphins that tended to also be helping out the humans.
So not all the dolphins were helping out the humans, only some of them.
Exactly. And what the researchers think is because these closely knit dolphins are more likely to help the humans, that something about this cooperative behavior they have with people must be learned. And the idea is that dolphins with tighter bonds will be more likely to pick up each other's behavior. So if some of them are behaving friendly towards the people and helping them out, they're going to pass that behavior on to the other dolphins they're hanging out with. Mothers may pass this behavior down to their offspring, and therefore you have this sort of continuation of the behavior generation after generation.
Is this sort of behavior more genetic or environmental in nature? Do we have any idea?
It's really not clear. It could be genetic. It could be environmental. What's really interesting is it actually could be part of a dolphin culture. Now, culture is something that's very controversial when we talk about other animals. It's sort of not clear in many scientists' mind whether other animals actually have culture like we do. mother dolphins, for example, are intentionally changing their behavior in order to instruct their offspring. From what the research has seen right now, it's more of a correlation. They haven't actually seen this active behavior change. And that doesn't mean it's not happening, but they just haven't done the experiments to test that. But if they do find that that's the case, that would actually be a strong indication that it's actually part of these dolphins' culture to help people, which would be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. But they don't see this anywhere else in the world as
not
far as we
know? Not anywhere else, no.
Wow. All right. And moving from culture into evolution, we have a story about the evolution of modern humans.
Right. Well, the story is not so much about evolution, but more about natural selection, which is sort of the driver of evolution. For evolution to work within a population of individuals, some individuals have to preferentially survive better than other ones or mate better than other ones in order to pass their genes down to the next generation. Now, the question of whether natural selection or evolution is still happening in humans is really controversial. And a lot of scientists don't think we're still evolving or still subject to natural selection anymore. The primary reason being that we've become so well equipped as a species. You know, when it's cold outside, we've developed ways to deal with that. You know, we've got heavy clothing. When we get sick, we've developed medication. So a lot of things that would have killed us in the past and would have sort of weeded out certain individuals in our species don't really seem to do that anymore. That's not actually what this new study finds. Now, this new study wasn't conducted with people in the modern era. It was actually looking at people that lived a couple hundred years ago in Finland. But this is still a time where human beings were still fairly well adapted to their environment. The researchers here were dealing with a bunch of farmers in a few fishing villages in Finland. Now, these farmers had a lot of land. They had sort of tamed their environment. So they had access to a lot of food. They had access to a lot of things that would sort of help them ward off the kinds of things that might kill animals just out there in the wild. But what the researchers found is despite all this, these individuals still seem to be subject to the whims of natural selection.
So what were we able to find out about these people to even start the study in the first place?
Well, Carrie, what the researchers did here is they looked at four aspects of the lives of these people, things that would influence survival and reproduction, which, as I said earlier, these are really the key sort of signposts of natural selection. They looked at who lived beyond age 15. You know, if you're living beyond age 15, chances are you're going to be starting to mate, for lack of a better word, and passing your genes on to the next generation. You're going to get married. So looking at all these different factors in these people, and what they found is that, first of all, in these villages, almost half of the people died before age 15. So that's a lot of people dying before they're really reaching good reproductive age. And that suggests that this population is still subject to the forces of natural selection. Also, of those that did make it through childhood, 20% didn't get married. And that suggests that maybe they had some sort of trait or behavior or whatever it was that prevented them from getting married. And again, if you're not getting married, especially in this culture back a couple hundred years ago, you're not going to be having children. And again, you're not passing your genes on to the next generation.
So while we do have all of these modern technologies and these modern protections, I mean, I wonder if this could still be playing out today in the 21st century at all.
Yeah, it's a great question, Carrie, because even though this study was sort of relatively recent in human history, in terms of the kinds of medicine that these people had, modern medicines, they were still sort of light years behind where we are today. You can't even probably name or think of a modern population of humans living in a developed country where half the people are dying before age 15.
Right.
You know, we've got antibiotics, we have all these medicines. So it's still open to question whether what the researchers saw happening a couple hundred years ago is still really happening today.
All right. And now we move outside of the Earth into a story of cosmic predator and prey.
Right. This last story, Carrie, is about a very unfortunate star that was ripped to shreds by a black hole. Now, this actually happens quite a bit. Most large galaxies have giant black holes in the center of them. In fact, our own Milky Way has a black hole in the center, which is about 4 million times more massive than our sun. So it's a really, really big guy. And these black holes have been known to swallow stars. So what astronomers saw in this new study isn't really that new. What's new here is that we're able to monitor enough of the event taking place to infer a lot about this unfortunate star that got ripped to shreds.
So how did we spot it in the first place?
Well, astronomers using a telescope in Hawaii spotted a flare that was actually in the visible wavelength in 2010. So this must have been a very bright thing happening. And the distance was about 2.1 billion light years away. So to see light from that far away, it had to be a pretty dramatic event. So they took a closer look and they did some calculations. And what they figured out is that there was a black hole in this region that they were looking at that's about 3 million times more massive than our sun. So slightly smaller than the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And that it seemed to have swallowed about half of the star when the researchers sort of spotted it. The star, when it's sort of swallowed, sort of shredded, releases obviously a tremendous amount of energy, which is what the flare that the astronomers saw. And by sort of analyzing the various spectrum and doing some calculations, the researchers calculated this star was probably born about a billion years ago. It probably once was not too dissimilar from our sun, but at some point the star became a red giant, which is basically a star with a helium core surrounded by a puffy outer layer of hydrogen. And what the researchers think happened is this star was somehow in a bad orbit, or maybe it got kicked out of its solar system, which has been known to happen. And at some point it approached this black hole, got about as close as Pluto is from our sun. And by that point, it was pretty much all over. The star got sucked into the black hole. The black hole stripped off the hydrogen envelope, leaving the star with only its helium core, which is about a third of the sun's diameter and about a quarter of its mass. And when the star got within 50 million kilometers of the black hole, which is about a little bit closer than Mercury is to the sun, the black hole pretty much tore to pieces. And actually, the researchers think it didn't actually tear the entire sun into pieces. Some of it actually shot away from the black hole at an enormous speed. So this was a pretty devastating and dramatic event for the star. And again, really cool that astronomers were able to catch most of this happening in action.
Right, right. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Care for Science Now, we've got a story about yawning dogs. Why dogs copy us when we yawn, which is usually something only people do with other people. Also a story about the science of slosh. Why do we spill drinks when we walk? News you can use. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about why protesters in the UK are threatening to destroy a wheat field. Also a story about a new federal court ruling on the reburial of 9,000-year-old Native American bones. Mm-hmm. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about SETI and the search for extraterrestrial life. And next week's Science Live is about the political brain. Why do conservatives and liberals view science differently? Mm-hmm. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. I will. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the May 4th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.